We are now in the darkest time of year. It is no coincidence that Christmas and Hanukkah, both festivals of light, fall near the winter solstice. It's not just because earlier pagan holidays fell at this time of year, but rather because ancient solstice festivals share a spiritual template with Christmas and Hanukkah. They all speak to our primal need for light in the midst of darkness. Hi, I'm Rabbi David Siegel of the Aspen Jewish Congregation, and this is Light Matters on Aspen Public Radio. In the spirit of the season, we just heard Aspen local Dan Sheridan's song, Be the Light. We all search for light in dark moments. What would it mean to be the light when we face darkness? Ebenezer Scrooge was haunted by three ghosts who taught him the meaning of the holiday season. Today, we are blessed to be visited by three good souls who bring light and warmth to dark and cold places. My first guest is Allison Daly, Director of Pathfinders. Allison and her team provide counseling and support for those struggling with serious illness or loss. I was thinking about Allison and Pathfinders this week as I watched the Charlie Brown Christmas special with my son for the umpteenth time. It begins notably in sadness. Charlie Brown opens up to Linus. I think there must be something wrong with me, Linus. Christmas is coming, but I'm not happy. I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy. I always end up feeling depressed. Of course, there's nothing wrong with him, or the many people for whom the holidays aren't purely happy. At this time of year, grief and loss are more pronounced. The empty chair at the holiday table tempers the festive spirit. It is in that darkness that Allison is called to be the light. I'm so grateful that you took the time to talk with us today. So I'm here to welcome Allison Daly. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what Pathfinders is, mission, and what the work you do.
First of all, thank you for asking me. And, you know, I'm the executive director and also the grief counselor for Pathfinders. And Pathfinders is a local nonprofit that provides counseling and volunteer services from Aspen all the way up to Parachute. And that includes people who have cancer, any kind of serious illness, and then grief and loss.
So what we're talking about is approaching the darkest time of the year, which we're in, and thinking about darkness in a lot of different forms. Mm-hmm. You're called in for people when they're facing dark times in their life. What do you try to bring with you into those interactions? And you think of it in terms of bringing light to them, but in your own words, what is it that you see yourself called to do?
Well, you know, and what's interesting about that is that probably in the darkest times there is so little light, you know, and it's like partly what I feel like I bring is just a space for them to be able to sort of be in the darkness and not be maybe as afraid or as affected as they might have been. In other words, you can be, it's sort of like when a child is in the dark and they're scared, but if somebody's with you, it just takes a little bit of the edge off. And I guess that's sort of how I feel about what I do, is that I can show up, I can be present, I can hold them if they want to be held, I can just sit with them, but I can really hear all the different things that they're feeling and thinking and that they're confused about.
Responding to that analogy of mm-hmm. being with a child in the dark, it's interesting that I think many of us, our impulse is, we just want to turn the light on.
Yeah, that's true.
But in a situation where you can't do that, mm-hmm. what is it that you can do?
Well, you know, to say that is that, you know, it's true that we don't want the darkness. And yet, you know, what's interesting is that most everybody will experience darkness. And that's why I guess I feel like it's important to be able to sit in that space with someone. Because inevitably, at some point in everyone's life, they will experience some form of darkness. So if we can not only be present with somebody else, but if we can be present with ourselves during those times, I think that can be a very powerful experience. I feel like for people, if they want to know how to sit with somebody, the main thing is to really get out of themselves, you know, to really take away any of the feelings or judgments or insecurities or uncomfortable feelings that they're feeling, around what's happened. And if they can just show up from the place of loving that person and really deciding to just stay with them, that to me is one of the greatest gifts. Because, you know, there, if you've lost a child or if you've lost someone who you love so deeply, there's nothing that anybody can say to make that okay. It's just, it's never going to be okay. But if you can just be with them in that and just let them scream, yell, rage, whatever it is that they need to do, then they feel safe with you in a way that they weren't feeling safe maybe before. And they've got someone that's kind of in there with them, in their corner.
I have a colleague, a rabbi, who told me a story about going into a house of a family who had just lost a teenage child. Mm-hmm. And the mother just laid into him, the rabbi. And as he expressed it to me, it was anger that she needed to get out. Yeah. At God, at the world, at the universe. He was the identified, you know, target.
Yeah.
In a way. And after that played out the way it needed to, he was able to come back and she was able to come back with him and get to a different place. But it was just an interaction that had to happen in a way that I think would be hard for most of us to deal with.
And I think especially when you're in that position, whether it be, you know, a grief counselor or, you know, a rabbi or a pastor, I think sometimes people have certain roles. And if we can accept that role in that moment, we may be giving them one of the greatest gifts that we can.
Another thing you make me think of is, I think in our culture, we emphasize positive thinking, mm-hmm. maybe too much,
right,
to a superficial level, so that it leads us, when we go to sit with someone, like I said, we want to just flip the switch on and make it light again, or sweep the darkness under the rug.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is a way of saying to someone, I'm not really taking you seriously, or I'm not really hearing you,
right.
Because we're just going to make it better, right. Because I'm anxious.
Right, exactly. It's really about what they're feeling. And, you know, the truth is that's one of the things that if we can really get out of ourselves, I guess that's really what it's about. If we cannot feel like we have to go to that positive place, because it's really easy for people to say things like, oh, it was God's will, or whatever, those kind of trite things that we're used to hearing. If we can get out of that and really just, like you said, just be with them and hear them and acknowledge and really let them know that what they're feeling is absolutely real and okay.
So you literally get called into situations mm-hmm. when people are facing dark times, but in a higher sense of being called to this work, when did you feel like this was what you wanted to do or what you need to be doing? And how have you found the spiritual resources or emotional resources mm-hmm. in yourself to be able to do this kind of difficult work?
So I lost my brother to suicide when I was 24. And that was probably the first really hard thing that had ever happened to me. And because it was suicide and because I was the one who had to tell my parents and had to really handle a lot of details, I think that was sort of like the beginning, almost like training for what I was doing, in the sense of I really had to learn to be with other people. Then I think that eventually later on what I realized is that I can be in that space. And I wanted to do something that honored my brother. And it really just ended up morphing into doing what I'm doing. So that's, I would say that he's my real motivation for what I do, is just in the honoring of him. And then I would say that, you know, the people, like I would say that my husband, Art, who he had lost his family in Glenwood Canyon, and because of his own experiences, we ended up coming together in a really unique way. But he's able to really sit with me in these places. And he really gives back to me. He's got a lot of humor and he likes to have fun. And so we just, you know, I'm able to really, you know, shift and go to a different place with him. And then my two boys, Ryder and Burke, they're in college now. And they are at the place now where they really, you know, because I've been doing this for a long time, they really know how to handle me. You know, they'll give me a back massage or they'll just sit and talk with me. But they also know how to really kind of sit in that place with me and just let it be okay.
That's beautiful when children can turn around and provide that kind of role.
It is. It's pretty incredible.
Mine are 2 and 5, but there's still glimpses of that already.
Yeah, you can see it.
Do you have any specific stories, not with, you know, names or details, but just particularly moments that really affected you in terms of some of the work you're doing, or that could illustrate for our listeners the kind of work you do and the kind of thing you try to, the kind of presence you try to be for people?
Well, you know, I have a couple of clients. I mean, almost all of my clients, I feel like it ends up being there's something that I take away from it, that it either deeply moves me or it really affects how I am in the world. And I would, so one of the ones is, and it's someone that we both have in common, but it's a family that lost a little boy to sudden unexpected death syndrome. And one of the things about that family that I just so appreciated, and I've talked about this before, is the fact that their faith, you know, that their Judaism really became something that strengthened them. And I loved the ritual around honoring and remembering their son within their faith. And I really appreciated the questions that they had to go through. Like, they didn't just jump to their faith. They actually really grappled and questioned, and I loved that. And then it came, what I've really watched is that they have really operated from that place of honoring, that they went through the fire and they experienced the really hard stuff. And not that it's ever over, but that they now really do operate from the place of honoring the little boy. So that's one that that deeply, deeply affected me. The other one that I will mention is, it's actually a family who, they don't live here, but they have roots here. And they lost a 7-year-old when he was hiking. He actually, a rock fell onto him. And so I got connected to him through people through here. And I worked with the family mostly by phone, but then when they would come and visit, I would spend time with them. And they, one of the things that was so beautiful about them was that they ended up, and I will say, I mean, the fire that they went through and the pain and the anguish was immense, but part of their honoring was they set up a fund after their son called Lyle's Angel Fund. And so every month they send a check for a specific amount of money. And they know that I'm, because of the fact that I work with a nonprofit, that I'm usually in contact with people that can't afford things. And so it's helped pay rent. And it's not like a large sum of money, but it's enough to where it can pay groceries. It can help pay for funeral costs. So it's kind of this amazing thing that kind of came from that they have really, it makes them feel good. And every month I know when the check's coming, because I always have this little thing inside of me that I feel like Lyle's guiding me to where it needs to be. And it's almost to the day that he'll let me know where that money needs to go. Something will come forward. And they just love it. They want to hear the stories every month. So those are two, you know, really profound things that I've really noticed and really appreciated in my practice.
Thank you for sharing those. Very, very powerful to think about how to be present with families, and the loss of a child being, I can't imagine anything worse for a parent or family to go through. And in the case of the Jewish family that you're talking about, that I do know, the mother has said that she and God are not on speaking terms.
I love that.
I think that's very profound. And at the same time, they're very involved in the Jewish community and believe in community and people connecting and finding support there.
Right.
And people really stepped up for them within our community. And I think that those two things can exist at the same time.
Absolutely. I just so appreciate her realness. Like, the realness with which she feels that, and yet her faith is so important to her. You know, it's like you can hate something and love something at the same time, or you can be mad at something and love something at the same time.
Well, the other thing that both of those stories made me think of, Louis C.K. was on maybe the Tonight Show a few months ago, and he's talking about how, you know, you're out driving and you look around and basically 100% of people are on their phones while they're driving or otherwise on their phones all the time. Mm-hmm. And his theory, which I think is right, is that when we start to feel something, maybe it's sadness, we just go to our phones.
Right.
And it's like this numbing effect. Mm-hmm. And he tells a story about being in his car once, and he felt that feeling, just sadness about just being alone and some stuff he was going through. And he went to reach for his phone, and then he put it down, and he just let the sadness wash over him, and he cried.
Mm.
And then after that ran its course, there was kind of a joy that swept in. And what it made me think of, like your stories and your work speak to, is that somehow joy and sadness are not opposites, or not, they're not enemies in a way. They're all there at the same time, or they can be.
They can, absolutely.
At the same time.
In fact, it's interesting because, you know, I came into my husband's life fairly early in his grief. And one of the things that I had lost my brother, and I had cried and I had done a lot of work, but I hadn't ever really howled. But one of the things that would happen is I would hold him, and he was on the floor. And I mean, I'd never seen anybody howl from that gut-wrenching place of pain. And yet he could howl, and then, you know, things would calm down, and then he could get up, and then he could feel a sense of joy after that, like just from feeling for them. In other words, he could go directly from that place of missing them so much to then just appreciating the love after he had really allowed himself to feel. And I think you're absolutely right that our society sort of teaches us to run from these things. And yet when we feel them, I think our emotions and our emotional intelligence is so much greater if we could just really go there.
And there are no shortcuts to it. Like, no. Actually, your body has to go through something to get to a different place.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I really feel that. And that grief and joy, actually, both are embodied feelings. They're something that happens in our head. Actually, they happen in our whole body, I think.
No, I agree with you. I think it does. And I think our head, our brain has to wrap itself around it, that it's safe to go both places. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yes.
It has to give us permission to not only go to those really, really dark places, but then it's okay to actually take steps out of the dark places into the light.
Well, I have to share with you a text. I'm just thinking of it right now, from a psalm. Those who sow in tears shall reap in joy. Mm. And it's often understood as a kind of, if you suffer in this life, you'll have eternal happiness. But I had a teacher in seminary who said, no, that's not what it's about. Her name is Debbie Friedman. She passed away a few years ago, but she said it to music, beautiful melody.
That's the one that Rollins sings.
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Yes. My wife sings that one beautifully.
It's one of my favorite songs ever.
And what this teacher, Debbie Friedman, said about it is that what it's about is that your capacity for sorrow is as deep as your capacity for joy is high. And if you think of it as sort of like a valley and a mountain.
Yeah.
And it's not that it takes away from sorrow so much as reminds you that when you're in the depth of something, that the howl you're talking about, that it's that same capacity you have to appreciate the love, or to remember, celebrate good moments as well.
Right.
I think that's deeply true. And you're right. We're taught to run from the depth of those feelings.
Yeah, we are. And yet there's, like you said, there's a beauty in both, even though we don't always want to look at it that way.
Right. And I think we all have moments of darkness, some more than others. And the question then becomes, what do you do with it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you're here.
That's right. I'm here for that. You know, and that's, and it's interesting because some people will come in and that's sort of what they're working with, not only if they've had a loss, but sometimes even if it's just a real emotional loss. And so sometimes it's just about kind of like peeling different layers off from ourselves, because I think we build a lot of protection. And sometimes protection's good, but sometimes we have to have a safe place to take some of that protection off, to get down to what it is that we're really feeling, and to feel safe in that place, and to feel heard, like you said earlier, to feel really, really heard, and then to be able to say, okay, now I can step back out into the world.
Well, on that note, the holidays are coming up. Mm-hmm. Christmas and Hanukkah start same night. Well, first night of Hanukkah is Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And the holidays, for people who have suffered a loss, the holidays can be very hard, any holidays. And I think maybe it makes it even worse that it's a time of year when you're expected to be happy and smile and, you know, joy and all that. And people feel like they have to hide maybe that darker feeling they're having around the empty chair at the table. What would be your advice to families and friends of loved ones who've lost someone, or people who've lost someone, around how to approach the holidays?
Well, you know, I think actually kind of what we're talking about, it's sort of, I think sometimes it's appropriate to go somewhere else or do something different. Like, I think sometimes a change of place can be important for people. But I always encourage people. It's interesting you said, when you said the empty seat, is one of the things that I have people do is I actually have them set a place at their table for the person. Because once again, it's one of those things that's sort of the elephant in the room that nobody really wants to talk about. And so to me, if you can set that place and let that person actually be present in the conversation and in the feeling, and you can, you know, it depends on really how people, where they're at emotionally and how raw the loss is. So I think it's really individual what people feel comfortable doing. But I do feel like that the more that they can find a way to access that person from the place of love and honor, the more they'll be able to process what they're really feeling. And for some people, you know, it's interesting. For some people, that means running. And I have zero judgment about that. Like, I just don't have any judgment around what anybody decides to do, as long as they're really aware of what they're doing. You know, if they can be really aware and say, you know, this year, it's not happening. We're going to take off and go wherever. We're not going to celebrate whatever the holiday is that they're celebrating. As long as they can say, okay, so you understand what you're doing, and this is what feels the right thing for you, perfect. Perfect. I just think it's important that they acknowledge and recognize that maybe this is the right thing for them now. And then work on the next holiday or the next anniversary or whatever's coming up, and let them kind of build steps to get to where they are ready to be more present during that time.
It's about honesty. It's about intention.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's about, well, it's certainly about self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And being free of judgment, that's a huge piece, yeah. I think, too, that we could all take a lesson from.
That's one of my biggest things that I feel like I really try to practice is just zero judgment. Like, really, if I can just be present with that person and really not be thinking about anything within my own mind of what I might think. I mean, obviously you don't ever want somebody who's, you know, who could hurt somebody else or hurt themselves. It's not, I'm cognizant of those type of things, but it's like really just letting their process be something that they own, and whatever things they're feeling, letting that just be okay. Because like you said, here this woman was yelling at the, you know, at the rabbi, and then later on it ended up being something they were able to really come into, you know. So sometimes we just hold places for people that we don't know where they're going to go next, but we just have to walk with them through it.
Allison, thank you
yes.
so much for
oh, I love
sharing.
This.
And it's I wish awesome. You a Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Happy Hanukkah.
Those who sow, sow in tears, will reap in joy, will reap in joy. Those who sow, we'll reap in joy. Those
Allison reminds us that joy and sadness are often mingled, and that our capacity for grief is equal to our capacity for love. She teaches us how to be present for someone in need, not by trying to fix, but by listening, honoring, holding. I'm Rabbi David Siegel, and you're listening to Light Matters on Aspen Public Radio. My next guest deals with Christmas more directly as the lead pastor of the Orchard Church in Carbondale. Charlie Hill has been at the Orchard for 14 years and in ministry for more than two decades. Like many religious leaders, Charlie and I find ourselves working at the intersection of secular culture and faith traditions. Charlie reflects on what spiritual seekers are looking for today, how the church can provide it or not, and what it means to do it all authentically. Charlie, thank you for joining me here for this conversation.
Well, David, I'm excited about it, for sure.
I was thinking about this time of year when we approach the coldest and darkest days, and thinking also to the story of creation, which begins in darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And God's first choice, if we can think of it that way, is to create light. And there's a way in which the holidays we're coming up to, Christmas and Hanukkah, are both about creating light in a moment of darkness, or in a moment of desperation even in some cases. But that's a fairly heavy way to start. But I guess to ask you the question in a way, what do you look forward to most in the Christmas season and in your celebration of it?
Well, I enjoy the fun of it. And of course, I love it in the context of church and what the church gets to be in community this time of year. And so, absolutely, the light, of course, from our perspective, Jesus coming into the world, is what we celebrate right there. Well, I know it's a time where, for a lot of people, it actually brings out the pains that they feel and the heartache that they have. I like being in the midst of that, providing an opportunity for some hope and some light.
Can you say more about that? How do you facilitate that in your, well, in your family, but also in your church community, helping people be present to those pains as at the same time as you encourage people to get into the fun of this and the warmth of the spirit?
I don't know that we're good at that, to be honest with you. But how do we do it? Well, I don't know that we intentionally engage in discussions around those things, but just the opportunity to provide fellowship. And, you know, like when we do our Christmas Eve thing, we've worked on this for years. What's our purpose in doing a Christmas Eve service? We'll have hopefully 850 people there this Christmas Eve. And it's just our whole intention is that it is a gift to the community. We want the community to put that in their routine. And I don't know. I think that having that be a part of their routine may interject some hope. And I'm not sure I can say that it has the most redemptive potential for every person who's in the midst of the loneliness that they might feel at Christmas. But if you want to engage, I think there's a pretty great opportunity to connect.
Well, I think even the idea of approaching something like a Christmas Eve service, which in my line of work would be like a Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur high holiday service, to approach it and something you're going to do regardless every year, right?
Right.
But still to approach it with the question of why are we doing this? What is this for? Is both very important and also can be very disruptive as a question.
No, that kind of disruption is the right kind of question.
I agree.
Yeah, we should be asking that about everything we're doing. And especially Christmas can get routine. And you're just in the flow of it if you're not intentional and on purpose. But that's what I'm saying. I think our purpose is kind of lighthearted, but that's an okay purpose.
I think as long as you're clear on it, you know, and honest about it, that's a lot of the ballgame.
And frankly, everybody for most of the year is pretty far from God. Their attention of any of these things is pretty far. And Christmas is an opportunity to connect in a way that crosses maybe even generational boundaries. I mean, if you're an older folk, you like Christmas and how it rolls around. But I think it's a time where younger millennial kind of folks can still do something nostalgic. So actually, we try and put on the nostalgic part of it. And
so there's
some light.
Childhood resonances for people, what Christmas meant to them as kids. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the fun of it. I mean, in our church, we're kind of, we have fun. Santa's there. We're not worried about all that stuff, actually.
Worried about in what sense?
Oh, you know, there's a vibe out there in a lot of religious Christian circles. Like, you got to put, don't lose Christ from Christmas. And obviously, and at the same time, you're missing, I think, some of the community fun, engagement. And so we're not about what we're against. We're more for what we're for.
I like that. I think that, well, all religious institutions have to wrestle with that these days when, as we know, affiliation patterns are down across the board in America, especially among younger Jews and Christians and others. I mean, I know it obviously from my angle in the Jewish community, but I try to stay grounded in that approach of what are we here for? What is our purpose? And you and I have talked about that idea of authenticity before.
Right.
You said, what does that look like from your perspective? Do you think that draws people in? What does it even mean?
Oh, well, certainly younger generation, millennial generation, that's their whole question. Are you authentic? It seems like it starts off with the assumption that you're probably not, so prove to me that you are. And I'm not actually sure how to prove that, other than trying to be authentic, which half the time means I don't know what we're talking about.
And to add to this, what does authenticity have to do with faith? I think people have a perception that faith is about certainty.
Yeah.
And I know you don't feel that way, and I'd love to hear you talk about why.
Oh, I think certainty has become an idol almost, where the need for it misses the whole journey and relationship in following God. This is a massive conversation, actually. But you know what's fun is that I think you and I are a lot more similar than at first pass. You know, the basic, our whole vision at the Orchard is love God and love people, which comes from the Shema, which is, that's you, man. That's the Jewish thing, right? Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And
that's a pretty big one for us.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing, right? Well, actually, I think the nuances of living that out draw you to be authentic. I'm not it, us too. I mean, I think people kind of resonate with, oh, that's what you're about. You're not about all that other stuff. Well, we plow through all that other stuff, but the desire to love God purely, whatever that is, and love people, that's where you get tested. And maybe people can see if you're authentic, if you just recognize you're in the journey of that. All the time I find that I'm not authentic. Like even when Christmas, we start this Christmas conversation actually, and you ask me these questions about the meaning of Christmas, and the next thing you know, I'm going, oh man, I'm not sure that we're all that authentic in how we roll in the traditions of it. Just so much fun, but then you ask these hard questions, and maybe we get around to being authentic. I'm not even sure that was an answer, but
I think it is. I think another thing we're getting around to is a lot of people think that religion is first and foremost about what you believe,
right?
And they won't even come in the door because that's a turnoff from before you even out of the gate. That
absolutely.
I don't believe that, so I'm not. It's not for me. But I hear you saying, and I share this, that belief is somewhere in there, maybe, but it's way down the list. What we care about is where does love fit into who you are and what you do.
Well, it seems like people think they know what you believe, and they assume, thinking they know what you believe, that they don't like you. Because I'm pretty sure I don't like what I think you believe, who I voted for, or whatever. And there's this relational thing. No, man, let's talk about it. You might find that the core things that I'm about resonate in your heart also. Because I actually think that loving God and loving people is kind of written in most people's heart anyway, whether they've discovered how that works or not. Yeah. So faith being a set of beliefs, that's really the second piece. Or I don't even know if that's a piece, actually.
Right. 'Cause, right.
I mean, from our perspective, obviously, I mean, there's just, it's just about Jesus and knowing him. So that's what we're about in a relational way, not in a set of things that we agree on.
And being inspired by that example and by those stories to live a certain way.
Yeah, we would say that it comes out of the reality of who he is. And then the challenge is when you find you're not living in light of that, the authentic part is being honest with yourself. There's a self-reflection and going, well, this doesn't seem to fit like who I say I am and what I think. I think that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also very powerful. I can just say out loud.
On the fly, I'm really not sure.
To hear a religious leader say, I'm just stumbling around in the dark too. I think that's really powerful. And I think people, just like people think religion or assume religion is about, or that faith is about certainty or belief, and I don't share that, I think people assume that religious leaders have it all figured out and, you know, have all the answers and sometimes look to us for the wrong things, maybe. And sometimes we play into that. I'll say that out loud for sure.
Yeah. Well, I don't know much. The few things that I can just really stand on are critical to me. But gosh, the longer I go at this thing, and I've been at it now for 25 years, I think the more childlike you actually get. You know, Jesus said, you got to come to me like little children. And to me, that means sort of the wonder, with a sense of wonder. Maybe that taps into Christmas a little bit. And you don't have a sense of wonder if you know everything. There's no amazement if you've got it all figured out. So I'm not trying to communicate that there aren't some basic things that I think you can know and move on. But at the same time, boy, now the sense of wonder being at this a while is increased. It's just kind of nice not to know everything.
And to be willing to be open at any moment to say, wow, I just learned something about myself that's new. And, mm-hmm. Oh, I was wrong about this. I think people are scared of that, maybe. I mean, I'm scared of it, too, let's be honest. But
well, that's authentic.
I also think that combination is so rare today of saying there are some core convictions that I hold on to and I'm prepared to move on in my life. And at the same time, I want to approach the world with a radical sense of wonder, openness, awe, humility, you know, insert right virtue there. I think a lot of the time we're presented with one or the other as an option.
Well, and I think a while ago I realized, well, I don't need to protect anything. There's nothing I need to guard. There's no set of even, I even realized that God doesn't need me protecting him. And so defending the faith and all that kind of stuff, it kind of moves to the side. I'm not trying to communicate that there aren't specific things that I believe in. And then I'm just all over the place. But I feel like the more you journey, the more it gets relational. And the more it gets relational, the less I have to defend. I have to think about that. That was either really profound or really stupid. And I'm not sure.
Maybe both. No.
It can be that way at the same time, can it?
I
hope
that
profound. That is.
I want to end with a couple lighter questions.
Please.
What's your favorite Christmas song?
Baby, It's Cold Outside. But we don't do that at Christmas Eve. I just want to tell everybody that. I don't know what
it's
it
good
is.
One. Good. It's a good jazz standard, a classic.
Classic, yeah.
It's good, and
it
is today.
I don't have a favorite Christmas song.
It's okay. We don't have
to. But that might be it. That might be it. What's yours, man?
Oh, good question. There's so many good ones.
Can a rabbi have a favorite Christmas song?
Can't. That's. We'll do another show about that. Can a rabbi have?
A lot of the best
Christmas songs were written by Jews. I will put that out there. But that's a whole other conversation. Oh, that's the Christmas song. Is that the one with chestnuts roasting?
Oh, that's a good one.
That's a quality.
That's quality.
I like a lot of them, I have to admit. Maybe we won't use this part, but I do like a lot of them. What are you doing yourself for Christmas with your family? What's Christmas at your house look like?
Oh, man, it's super fun now that we're empty nesters and I've got kids all over the country. And when they all come back. Family from all over comes to visit us because we're doing Christmas all the way through the evening, you know, because I'm on the job. And but the routine of it is pretty great. Well, I think. After Christmas Eve service, we'll have a cool family time, usually chilly at home and all that. And even with the kids being in college and all that, I'll still make them sit on the stairs and wait and tell them Santa's come down below. And they go, Dad, you know, that's fun. We'll have a big Christmas dinner later, and we'll have a few people who didn't have anywhere to go, which is all kind of fun to include them in the family. But, man, as soon as Christmas Eve service is over, it is just a clear path to relaxing.
Well earned. Well, I thank you for sharing. I wish you a very Merry Christmas, and look forward to celebrating a new year with you as well. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Talking to Charlie reminded me of words of wisdom from one of my teachers about religious life. He said, "There's no rule, but it has to be boring. Fun and joy, depth and searching, faith and uncertainty, these all can coexist, indeed must coexist, within authentic community." You're listening to Light Matters on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Rabbi David Siegel from the Aspen Jewish Congregation. Alejandra Magana understands the value and responsibility of community. Magana has lived in the Valley more than 4 years, and she is the director of lifelong learning for the Valley Settlement Project. Valley Settlement uses a dual-generation approach to empower low-income families to improve school readiness and achievement, economic stability, and community engagement. Inspired by her own experience, Alejandra helps other families create a sense of home and purpose in the midst of isolation and confusion. Alejandra, it's good to be with you. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor that you call me and say, "Can you please come?" Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Would you start by just letting us know a little bit about what your role is at Valley Settlement with the lifelong learning? What exactly do you do for mm-hmm. that?
Well, I'm the director of lifelong learning program and Valley Settlement. This is an adult education program. We are focused in the Latino community to create classes to engage them with the community, and that they believe that we have more possibilities here than only one job, that it's the common job for the Latinos, like housekeeping or something like that. I think we have more opportunities, but we only have to believe. And if we believe in us, our consequence, our children and the people around us will believe that we can do a better community and a better world and a better country So that's a part of our program, to create specific classes for people that doesn't know how to write and read in Spanish or computer in Spanish, and for people that want to get the high school diploma and it's hard for them to start in English, so we'll help them in Spanish. So it's a process. We know that we have to learn English, but we have to believe that we can do it.
And you help people believe that.
I try. Every day I try in the classes to, I always say, to change the chip and say, instead of I can't, I can. So that's the point.
Beautiful. Can you talk about your own journey to this point, and specifically about when you first landed in this valley? What was life like for you? What were you facing as far as challenges?
Well, I came here around 4 and a half years ago without no speaking English. So the first year I was at home and only taking care of my children and house and husband, and really depressed and sad because in Mexico I worked like an accountant, and here it's like I don't speak English. There's nothing to do here for me. So I was always like sad and part of the day crying. We came alone, only my husband, my children, and I. So we don't have family here in the valley. So it was so hard to be here. But my husband always support me, and of course, God. I really believe that God put me in this valley for some reason, because we have more options to go to California or other ways. But for one reason, God put me here, because it will be easier for me, for my children, because we will have a possibility to help other people.
Sounds like you're finding that reason.
Yes.
Every day.
Yes. So during the whole year, I was only at home.
And then who or what helped pull you out of that place of loneliness and isolation and into something different?
Mm-hmm. I didn't have friends, and my husband worked almost all day, since morning until night. So, but I don't remember exactly how this woman found me. But she came to my home and invited me to register my daughter to the Little Bus, that is another program for Valley Settlement. And she gave me clothes and she gave me toys for my kids. And it's like, there's people who can help me. And so I registered my daughter to the Little Bus, and that was like my first step outside my home.
And that required that you participate also, right, as a parent? It wasn't just your daughter going, you had to go too and do, right?
Yes. And that was my first step outside my home by myself, not with my husband by my side. So, and then, yes, I was a volunteer, like, in the parental program. There's another program for Valley Settlement, for a whole school year, and helping in third grade, believe it or not, teaching English. And it was a challenge for me, and the teachers saw something in me, and she told me, okay, you will teach English to the newcomers. So, and that's the, my confidence growed, and it's like I started learning English and be more confident to speak with people.
How did these new roles and new volunteering change your relationship with your children and how they see you?
Yes, it changed a lot because they saw me at the school helping other kids, and because I was studying English, I studied with my son that he didn't speak English too. So we studied together, and our son could see that we help others, and that encouraged him to help the people in his classroom. So, and my daughter too, once she told me, "Mom, I want to be like a volunteer like you. I want to help others." So that's the impact that we create in our children, to help others, to believe that we have no skills that we can share, and that can help others to believe that they can do something. So that was powerful, and it still is in our family.
So how did it unfold that Valley Settlement then reached out to you to move from being a volunteer to the director of this program?
They saw me that I was like always there doing more and more things, and the director of Valley Settlement came with a proposal to be the director of lifelong learning, and I told her no. No, I'm not ready, and my English is not good, and for the director you have to talk with more people and ask for things, and I can't do it. So I think Morgan, the director, spent like 2 weeks talking with me and the other persons in the office. I'm like, oh my gosh, maybe I have to take the challenge. And I didn't, and it's that I told you, God said like maybe you can do more things for the community. And I said, well, if I can do it, nothing happened. So, but I think I'm doing the best that I can. So asking for a scholarship, asking for grants, and looking for around for people who want to study, encourage them to do it. And I think that I'm doing things that I never thought that I could do it.
That's a miracle and wonderful to see. If someone's listening to this and wondering, how could I get involved? How could I help? What opportunities are there?
There are a lot of opportunities. So we have in Valley Settlement, we have tours that the people can come to visit us and talk with us about our experience and story that we have with our students. So we have people from the tours that are volunteer in our classroom. They help our students in the English class, like a tutoring, and it's only to speak with our students, like a conversation, only to that our students can practice and be more confident that you are an Anglo, but you don't laughing. If my English is not good, you only want to help me. So in another way is for a grant, if you have like a little money or more money and you want to do something for the community and give us something that help our students or our participants in the organization could be really, really good.
Okay, thank you. As you think about other people who may be in a place where you were 4 years ago, lonely, isolated, in a place of darkness, whether in Latino community or not, what message do you want to share with them about finding some hope mm-hmm. based on what you've experienced?
To believe that God always have the right thing for us. Maybe at the beginning we don't understand, but when you think about it, you will find the answer. And believe that God put people around you to help you. You only have to open your eyes and take and hold the hand that it's telling you, I'm here to help you. And we are the same in the world. We only have to believe and trust each other and think that we have a lot of things to do in our community and in our world.
Beautiful message as we look toward the Christmas holiday, Hanukkah, New Year. Thank you for blessing us with that wish. And I wish you a Merry Christmas. Feliz Navidad and Happy New Year.
Feliz Navidad. Thank you for inviting me.
As I reflect on the wisdom shared by our guests, I think about the connections to our winter holidays. Hanukkah celebrates freedom, rooted in a story of victory over persecution. Christmas celebrates love, rooted in its story of God's gift of love in the form of a child. You don't have to believe in the fact of either tale to appreciate their inherent truth. All humans want freedom and love. We need to be free and to feel loved. As it turns out, the surest way to fulfill these two needs, whether you're Ebenezer Scrooge or Charlie Brown or a listener, is to give them away, to embrace and empower your neighbor's freedom, to love your neighbor as yourself. These together are the higher calling at the heart of our winter holidays. Every moment is a chance to love freely and fully, to be the light for someone struggling in the dark. May our holidays and every day be filled with light. I'm Rabbi David Siegel. Thanks for listening to Light Matters on Aspen Public Radio.